China basically didn't communicate this quickly, which is different to what happened during SARS-CoV-2. During that outbreak, they actually reported it relatively quickly. But back in the day for SARS-CoV-1, they basically reported this very late, and that was, of course, not very helpful because the virus could spread without people knowing about it.
Virological with Florian Kramer.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Virological. This episode was recorded on March 3rd of 2026 in Austria in Western Styria. And today we're going to talk about a coronavirus. Actually, a coronavirus that caused SARS epidemic, a SARS outbreak before SARS-CoV-2. It's actually the reason why SARS-CoV-2 is called SARS-CoV-2. There was a similar virus before, and that virus was named SARS-CoV initially. Now a lot of people refer to it as SARS-CoV-1. And so when this outbreak happened, initially it wasn't clear what was causing it. And so the first name was the name for the disease, in this case, severe acute respiratory syndrome, so SARS. And then once it became clear that it was caused by a coronavirus, the virus was named SARS coronavirus or SARS-CoV. A little bit about coronaviruses. Coronaviruses have a positive polarized RNA genome, single-stranded, and it's about 30,000 base pairs long, which is pretty large for an RNA virus. These viruses are called coronaviruses because when you look at them under an electron microscope, they look a little bit like a crown, and that's where the name corona comes from. SARS coronavirus specifically is part of the beta coronaviruses, and within the beta coronaviruses, it's part of the Sarbeco virus group. Sarbeco virus, the term basically brings together SARS and then beta corona, so Sarbeco, and SARS coronavirus 2 is also part of the Sarbeco viruses. So SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2 are pretty closely related. But there's a lot of other Sarbeco viruses that circulate in animals, specifically in bats. And we'll get to that later. How does the virus look like? Basically, we have the genome on the inside. The genome is protected by a nucleoprotein. Then we have a lipid envelope. And in this lipid envelope, we have both a matrix protein and an envelope protein. And the spike protein is also anchored in this lipid envelope. And the spike protein is the major surface glycoprotein of the virus that the virus uses for binding to our cells. The spike protein of SARS coronavirus 1 looks very, very similar to the spike protein of SARS coronavirus 2. And it actually also binds to the same receptor, angiotensin converting enzyme 2 or ACE2. So both viruses use the same receptor to get into our cells. A little bit about the disease. The incubation time is somewhere between 1 and 14 days. Typically, it's 4 to 6 days, but it can be as long as 14 days and as short as 1 day. The symptoms are flu-like, basically. Typically, people get a fever, muscle pain, they become lethargic and tired. A cough often develops, a sore throat, shortness of breath, and then pneumonia. And in a lot of cases, this is a severe disease. As the name says, severe acute respiratory syndrome. The mortality rate or case fatality rate back during that outbreak was about 10-11%. How is the virus transmitted, or how was this virus transmitted? Via the respiratory tract mostly, partially via respiratory droplets, partially also via aerosols, and could also be transmitted via fomites, so via basically contaminated objects. And in some cases, it was also transmitted via the fecal-oral route. In general, the R-naught, so the reproductive number, was between 2 and 4. So one person infected between 2 and 4 other people. And that's in line with what SARS-CoV-2 did in the beginning. So that's not that much different. But there were two things that were different. The first one is, in many cases, we had what we call super spreaders. So basically, one person infecting a huge amount of other people. That's what we call a super spreader. And that was much more pronounced during SARS-CoV-1 than it was during SARS-CoV-2. And the other thing that distinguishes SARS-CoV-1 from SARS-CoV-2 and that made it easier to stop the outbreak was that SARS-CoV-1 only started to transmit once people became symptomatic. And that's an important distinction. Because when people are symptomatic, when they have a fever, they're easier to identify. And then you can fish them out, you can isolate them, you can quarantine them. And doing that, you can stop an outbreak. For SARS-CoV-2, that's much more difficult because A, we have a lot of asymptomatically infected individuals, but they still transmit the virus. And we didn't have a lot of asymptomatic cases for SARS-CoV-1. That didn't seem to be much of a thing. And for SARS-CoV-2, you can also already infect other people before you become symptomatic. And so it's really hard to stop a virus that does that because you already gave the virus to other people before you even knew that you were infected, that you were becoming sick. And that was different for SARS-CoV-1, where most infections were caused by people who had symptoms. And so it was easier to fish them out. So what happened back in the day with this outbreak? The outbreak started in November of 2002 in Foshan, which is a city in Guangdong. And it took quite a while until China reported this outbreak to the WHO. They reported it on February 11th of 2003. And at that point, they already had 305 cases. 105 of them were healthcare workers, and that's not a good sign. So basically, people got infected, then went to the hospital and started to infect people there. So China basically didn't communicate this quickly, which is different to what happened during SARS-CoV-2. During that outbreak, they actually reported it relatively quickly. But back in the day for SARS-CoV-1, they basically reported this very late. And that was, of course, not very helpful because the virus could spread without people knowing about it outside of China. And in fact, the virus did spread outside of China relatively quickly. It's actually super interesting because this was investigated and the infection chains were investigated. And the first outbreak that started outside of China in Hong Kong could be traced back to an infection chain in the Sun Yat-sen Memorial Hospital in Guangzhou. That's the capital of Guangdong. So a person, I believe a fishmonger, went to that hospital on January 31st of 2003 because he was sick. And in that hospital, he infected about 30 healthcare workers. One of these healthcare workers was Liu Chanlun, who then went to Hong Kong on February 21st of 2003 to visit relatives. And he checked into the Metropole Hotel in Hong Kong. He had a room on the 9th floor, room 911. You can imagine how many conspiracy theories came out of that just because of that number, 911. And yeah, he checked into that hotel and then started to visit family in Hong Kong. And at the hotel alone, he infected 23 other guests. And of course, he also infected family members that he visited. And unfortunately, he died on March 4th of 2003. Approximately 80% of all cases, all SARS-CoV-1 cases in Hong Kong can be traced back to Liu Chanlun. And this is what I mean with super spreaders, right? So he really infected a lot of different people. And from Hong Kong, the virus traveled on. Another person who got infected in Hong Kong, Johnny Chen, went to Vietnam, fell sick and then was admitted to the French hospital in Hanoi and died there on March 13th. But he already had infected healthcare workers there, including Carlo Urbani, epidemiologist who worked for the WHO. And unfortunately, Carlo Urbani also died on March 29th from the infection. One of the main SARS-CoV-1 strains that is used in research is actually the Urbani strain, which was isolated from him. The virus didn't stay in Southeast Asia. It also made it to the Americas. Quansui Chu was also a guest at the Metropole Hotel, got infected there, and afterwards went back to Canada, to Toronto. She got sick there and was admitted to the Scarborough Grace Hospital in Toronto, and unfortunately died on March 5th, but also infected healthcare workers there and infected patients there. That led to the first wave of SARS-CoV-1 in Canada. And then there was a second wave that was associated with the North York Hospital, also in Toronto. And we'll get to the numbers in a minute, but Canada had quite a few cases of SARS-CoV-1 infections. Another interesting case is what happened at Amoy Gardens. Amoy Gardens is a complex of high-rise residential towers in Hong Kong. And one of the visitors at one of the apartments in one of the high-rise towers was infected with SARS-CoV-1. And I mentioned earlier that sometimes you have the fecal oral route infection route associated with SARS-CoV-1. And SARS-CoV-1 also quite frequently caused diarrhea as symptom. And so this person had diarrhea and used the restroom in one of these apartments, flushed the toilet, and there was something wrong with the plumbing system. And so the toilet produced a lot of aerosol, and that aerosol left the building and spread in this complex and actually made it into some of the other high-rise towers there. And that led to about 300 infected individuals and unfortunately approximately 40 deaths. And the interesting part here is really this was a building-to-building spread via aerosol that came from defective plumbing system that somebody used who had diarrhea who was infected with SARS-CoV-1. There's actually a very nice paper that describes this incident, and they looked at, you know, wind direction, wind speed, and so on and so forth, and figured out why some of the towers had cases and some of the other towers didn't have cases. It had, of course, to do with the wind direction and how that aerosol was spread. It's a very nice paper, and it's very, very nicely worked out. So the peak of this epidemic was in May of 2003, and a lot of countermeasures were put in place. People were quarantined when they had a fever. The airport started to measure temperature of travelers by infrared cameras. If you had elevated temperature, you got fished out and quarantined. And as I mentioned earlier, only people who were symptomatic were transmitting the virus, and so this helped. And they were actually able to control this outbreak just by quarantining people and isolating them. And the outbreak officially ended in June of 2003. The countries that were most affected were China and Hong Kong, and then Taiwan had a lot of cases. Canada had 241 cases and 43 deaths, so Canada had a lot of cases, and it was amazing that they could stop it. Singapore also had a lot of cases, and Vietnam had a lot of cases. The US had 27 cases and no deaths, so I guess the US was lucky in that sense that there was no big outbreak like in Canada. And globally, there were about 8,000 cases associated with this outbreak and about 800 deaths. So case fatality rate of about 10%. It was a little bit higher, maybe 11%, if you look at all the numbers. Globally, there were in total about 8,000 cases and about 800 deaths. So case fatality rate was about 10%. The amazing thing about this outbreak is we all still remember SARS-CoV-2, right? For SARS-CoV-2, from the beginning, we had ways of detecting the virus, ways of testing people if they were infected, all these PCR tests and so on and so forth. But this was absolutely not the case for SARS-CoV-1. It took until April of 2003 to figure out what was actually causing this outbreak. At that point, the virus was identified, the genome was sequenced. This was first achieved in Canada at the British Columbia Cancer Agency. And the virus was then isolated in Hong Kong by Malik Baris, I believe. And at Erasmus Medical Center in the Netherlands, they then infected macaques with this virus and could reproduce the disease. So there was really an international effort to tackle this, to figure out what's going on and to identify the causative agent. But again, this wasn't clear until April of 2003. So for most of the outbreak, there were no PCRs, there was no testing specifically for the virus. Infected people were identified by just, you know, looking at symptoms and then isolating them. And that's how the outbreak was controlled. As I mentioned, the outbreak was declared over in June of 2003. There were infections afterwards. They were laboratory associated. In Singapore, a person got infected in a lab in August of 2003. In Taipei, in Taiwan, in December of 2003, so these are single cases. And then in April of 2004, one person got infected in a laboratory in Beijing and passed the virus on to six more individuals, but this cluster could be stopped. So since then, this virus has not been circulating in humans, but it's certainly out there in the animal reservoir. And of course, there were a lot of investigations after the outbreak because people wanted to figure out where this virus came from. And it became clear quite quickly that all kinds of animals at wet markets in China, in Guangdong, were infected with this virus. This included palm civets, raccoon dogs, ferret badgers, but also domestic cats. And in 2005, it was found that Rhinolophus bats also carried the virus, or a virus that was very closely related. And so these are horseshoe bats. They're relatively common all over Asia. Some of them even exist in Europe. And actually, SARS-like viruses have been found in Rhinolophus bats in Europe as well, I think in Bulgaria. But the idea in the end was that these bats are sometimes found on wet markets as well. Sometimes sold on these markets. The idea was that these bats carried the virus, and then basically at wet markets and holding pens infected the civets, infected the raccoon dogs, infected other animals, and then the virus jumped from these animals that were sold to customers into humans. And that seems to be how this outbreak developed. And later on, the potential source of the virus in terms of the bats was also identified. It seems that you can trace back the virus to a bat cave in the Yunnan province. So this virus is probably still out there, but again, hasn't caused any issues since 2003. And it's likely circulating in bats, but not in humans anymore. Of course, after the outbreak, people started to look into countermeasures. Vaccines were developed. Two vaccines made it into clinical trials in early stage phase one trials. One DNA vaccine that NIH developed in the US, and then one inactivated virus vaccine that was developed in China and that also made it into a phase one trial. And this is actually a vaccine that is very similar to the SARS-CoV-2 inactivated vaccine that was also developed in China in 2020 and was used in a lot of different countries. Of course, there were many other vaccine approaches that were developed too preclinically, so in animal models, but never made it into clinical testing. And even the two vaccines that made it into clinical testing was stopped after phase one because there was no need, right? The virus was eradicated from humans, wasn't circulating anymore, and there was no need to further clinically develop these vaccines. I think what's also interesting to mention is that with our exposure now to SARS-CoV-2 through infection, through vaccination, and so on and so forth, we actually do have neutralizing antibody titers against SARS-CoV-1. So if you take blood from random people in the human population right now and you run neutralization assays against SARS-CoV-2, of course, a lot of people have very high neutralizing antibody titers. But if you run neutralization assays against SARS-CoV-1, you also find some neutralizing antibodies, much, much lower titers, much lower concentration. But people now have neutralizing antibodies against this virus. And so in my opinion, it's very unlikely that SARS-CoV-1 currently would be pandemic threat or an issue in terms of causing another outbreak, because we have all these antibodies in the population. There's probably a lot of resistance. And so, in my opinion, this is unlikely that this virus would make it in the human population and could cause a larger outbreak. On the other side, viruses are often unpredictable, so maybe I shouldn't even say that. But again, there is some immunity in the population against this virus now. All right, that's it for today. Super interesting outbreak back in 2002, 2003. It's actually amazing to see that it could be stopped. This could have easily been another pandemic, but it was able through global efforts to stop this outbreak and to basically end it in June of 2003. As always, if you have any comments, questions, suggestions, concerns, please write an email to virological@podcastwerkstatt.com. And if you like the podcast, you can support it on Steady. Thanks for listening, and until next week.
If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to support our work, visit us on Steady. You'll find the link in the show notes. And don't forget to follow and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Podcast Werkstatt.